Oh, baby.
What?
Just give me something. Jesus. Anything. Anything.
Right back at you, B.
This is a practical impossibility.
What kind of a stupid idea is that?
It's ringing.
Ray, right. Love the show.
This is the Ray Foley Podcast.
Ireland, I'm so sorry. This is ridiculous.
Ireland, I'm so sorry. This is ridiculous. I was podcasting on a weekly basis Saturday mornings. Hello, welcome to your weekend. I'm Ray Foley. This is my friend JP.
How you doing?
I'm on the Instagram at Ray Foley Insta. And you can listen to our, we have a radio show, you see. Tell your mums and dads that they can tune over. They can, instead of listening to Joe Duffy, they can switch over and turn on Today FM between 2:30 and 4:30. And we're on there just like talking and just having a good time, celebrating the joys of life, celebrating some positivity and reading out texts and emails and stuff and just generally having a good time.
Is the podcast a feeder drug for the radio show or is the radio show a feeder drug for the podcast? How's that work?
I've no idea. I don't know. I don't understand the synergy.
Right. Okay. Okay. You don't understand the principle, the idea.
I don't get it.
Okay.
Here's what I know. What they do is they put food in the studio and they open the studio door and I end up, I sort of meander in here. I'm bashing my face against the glass,
yeah,
first of all. And then after about 20 minutes, I realize that the door is open and then I just can, you know, boof, boof, boof. And then I'm bashing. So there's the glass and then there's the wall and then I'm in the door. And then they close the door behind me and all of a sudden, before you know it, I'm recording another podcast.
Let me throw some words at you. Force multiplication and amplification.
Yeah.
It's all about amplifying and forcing the multiplication.
Wow, that's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, I went to a course or something.
You went to a course or something?
I did, yeah.
I have a great story to tell. This is, how do you feel about this, dear listeners? What's your situation like when it comes to parking? You live in an apartment block, JP. You probably have a dedicated parking space, do you?
I do. Yeah, I have to pay for that. Or I bought it as part of the apartment itself, yeah.
When you bought the apartment, it was extra, was it?
No, it was part of the package, but I could have sold it off. I can sell off the space if I want, or I could rent it out.
If you sell it then, wow. So if you sell it, it's gone forever, is it?
Well, yeah, unless I manage to buy it back in some way, shape or form, but I don't see how that would
happen. How do they prove ownership of your space in the basement of your apartment building?
Do you know what? It's all done on a, I guess, respect and, oh yeah, that car's always there. So that is their space basis. So you wouldn't park in a random space. And by God, I have come back when there've been people visiting. Somebody might be staying with somebody sleeping over and leaving their car.
In your space.
And it might be in my space. And by God.
It is the worst. It is the worst crime. Really, it's up there with not picking up your dog poo. Anyone that parks in a space that is explicitly someone else's space, you need to be rounded up and shot.
It'd be like returning home and finding somebody else in bed with your husband.
Absolutely. I'm intrigued by the selling it aspect of it then, that it's sold and sold forever. But it came with your, it was assigned to you. Like, would it not be a more sensible way of doing it would be to long-term lease it or establish a setup where it's like, all right, I'm not going to use this for this year. I definitely know I'm not going to use it this year. So for 2024, I'll let someone else use it. I'll come to an agreement with them. I'll take money off them. But then I might need it back then. There's probably an app for that as well, isn't there? There is.
Possibly, yeah. I don't know why that would make more sense, though. I mean, I guess the person who originally bought it figured, I am definitely going to be using a private car, so I will need a private space.
Well whatever happens with, because you own the apartment, there's no point in you having an apartment if you don't have a parking space. Just in terms of like selling the apartment on, even it's like, oh, this I've already sold the parking space.
It doesn't come with a space. Is a
that's
yeah,
a weird
it's
one.
It's not a selling point.
Yeah, so you do need to hold on to it and maybe just lease it out. I'm sorting your life out for you over here.
Ray Foley Financial Solutions.
Hi there. Log on to my app. I've got an app and a website. All you have to do is give me your email address, and I'll send you a free Excel spreadsheet where you fill out all of your details and send it in. I'll add you to my mailing list, and then from there, we'll have a community of savers and spenders.
These online financial advisors or people who are kind of like, I'm relatable and here's some financial advice. I don't trust them. Anyway, you were getting into car
What's
spaces
that?
There.
What? What's that? You do, why not? Have a cough there.
I don't know, because I feel like they're
selling you something.
They're definitely selling me something, and they're not in the traditional space of I'm going into that building where they specialize that, and now somebody's going to tell
me. You're so untrustworthy.
Details.
Do you ever follow your man? Oh, what's his name? He's got a funny name, like Spice or Simon Spice or Simon Spruce or something like that. His name is. He stands in random places in all over the world, but usually in London. He's English. You have a cough there.
Good.
Is it all up?
Yeah, if you could put me over your shoulder and pat my back.
He's got a bit of a chest. Me too. There's this guy, Simon Squibb.
Squibb, right.
Simon Squibb. And it's actually quite inspirational. But it's also self-serving. But he's great. He's great. I love him. He's a guy, he seems like a really nice fella. And he stands there with a microphone in random spots. A lot of his videos I've seen are him standing on like a pedestrian bridge in London. What, a Millennium Bridge maybe? I don't know. And he randomly stops people with his microphone and he's being videoed and he says, sorry, can I stop you for a second? What's your dream? And then they say what their dream is and then he helps them achieve their dream or gives them some advice. It's usually either loosely financial and a little bit maybe of using social media to drive engagement and audience and then make a name for yourself and then become successful in whatever that dream is that you have for yourself.
Now that you mentioned what he does, I have seen him. I think I've seen him also even... give somebody, and I think it was out of the ordinary for what he normally does, he actually gave them, he promised to give them money on the sort of condition that they would follow these various steps that he'd mapped out because he wanted them to realise the dream. And I agree with you. On the surface, at least, it does seem lovely, yeah.
Yeah, but then it's all feeding into brand Simon Squibb as well, which is only good for him because he's the one that gets the clicks. And I haven't clicked or followed on any of the ones that he has shared or suggested from his community. I just watch him and I actually do quite like the stuff. I like the conversation he has with people where people, you can see a sort of a change in someone as they are going from who's this weirdo to internalizing, facing inward and going, thinking about their dream, really thinking about how they would invest in their dream and then listening to him give his advice. It is actually quite hopeful and lovely.
And I guess it's interesting to look at and to watch because most of us have an alternative dream, a way we would like to be living our life or a different way to be making money that we've always dreamt about, but have either fallen into a pattern of living that hasn't allowed us to get there or we didn't have the bravery or courage to go in that direction in the first place.
Wow, it's all coming out now, lads, isn't it?
Why aren't I an archaeologist like Indiana Jones, which I wanted to be when I was 10?
He doesn't want to be here working with me anyway.
I love this job.
Coughing
well,
his guts up
know.
In the studio, listening to me bitch every week.
To this job.
Yeah, my only dream really is to dream. Like literally to be in bed, asleep and dreaming. That's my dream. If I ever met Simon Squibb, I would say to him, I'm already living my dream and I want to be in bed instead of living my dream. Does that work for you, Simon? Will you give me €1 million for that, for just going to bed? And he'll have something. That's the thing as well about him. He does this thing where he's like straight away, he's like, well, here's what we'll do. And here's the plan. We'll do this and that and the other. And you'll be in bed before you know it. I'll be like, oh my God, Simon, give us a hug. Sorry, where are we going with
parking.
This?
Parking.
Oh yeah. Looked out my window this morning and my wife has gone to, we've got two, by the way, with our house, we're on an estate, but comes with the house, similar to your deal, comes with the house. We've two parking spaces. We've no driveways as such. We've two spaces outside the front of the house and they're ours. They're specifically for the house. They've got the number of the house on the space. Look out the window and there's a guy, a power washer, with a power washer. He's here for one of the other houses and he has just assumed, oh, there's an empty space, I'll take that. And he's parked in our car parking space.
Now, the space, here's the thing.
Now,
the space was empty.
You're going to do a Kate Carolyn. This is what my wife is completely and absolutely and utterly unreasonably reasonable when it comes to anything like this in our lives. I lose my nut and then my wife speaks to me as if I'm being the one that's been completely psychotically unreasonable, looking out the window and going, look at this lad here with the power washer parking in our car parking space and there's a sign on it. She does a thing where she's like, but he's not going to be there for long and he's doing his job and sure, we weren't using it anyway. Sure, I'll just park across the road. It's no big deal. I'm like, that's besides the point.
See, I'm team Kate on this.
Of course you are.
No, but there's a limit.
Jimmy always does this as well.
No, I don't just take her side to be difficult.
It's not just Kate. It's anti-me. It's not pro-Kate.
No, it's not.
It's anti-Ray is what it is.
No, I can be pro-Kate and that doesn't mean I'm anti-Ray. Okay? There are two different things. Don't you tarnish me with the anti-Ray brush just because I'm pro-Kate.
Whatever it is I do. I'm sick of the two of you.
No, that's not what it
is. Whatever it is, it's my view. It's like, oh, that's tip, but that's just you though, Ray.
Let's take the steam out of this.
Someone parks in your car parking space and you're raging about it. And he didn't ring the door and ask. He didn't knock in and go, listen, I'm so sorry to take your space. I can see that it's for your house, but it's near to where I need to do the particular task and I'll be gone within what... None of that. None of that.
See, it only really becomes an issue for a reasonable person. It would only become an issue when you do need to use that vacant space, and it is your space. However, I would agree that when you see a strange car in your space that you know at some point you're going to be using, the question is, how long is that person
going
to be
What's
there?
What's going on here?
Now, I get that. I do. I'm not anti-Ray.
We knew that he wasn't going to be there all day because he was there to do the power washing task. It's a different matter when someone actually just parks up and leaves it there. There was a situation where someone parked in someone's car park. By the way, we only get two. It's not like there's dozens of them. You get two. Someone parked in someone's car parking space. They came home and found someone parked there and they'd parked there overnight.
Ah, no. Do you leave a sign on the windscreen and the wiper, don't you?
Oh, I'd leave a sign, all right. The sign would be a screwdriver poking out of one of the tires.
Ah, no.
That's your sign to not park in my parking space.
I have done that, and then you're negotiating with yourself about how angry do I make the note I'm going to leave on their windscreen? Do you leave notes? Are you a note leaver? I've done it at least twice. Yeah,
I've considered buying those notes. You can get a pad of notes on Amazon that basically say you parked really badly or you shouldn't be parking here. I've never bought them, but I have considered. Like, they're pre-printed, and you just take it. It's like a sticky, or what's the yellow pads?
Post-it notes.
And they're just a pad of them that are in your glove box. You rip them off and you stick them under the windscreen wiper.
Would you worry that it means that you are identifiable then as the owner of the space? Because obviously the person who lives at that place...
Well, it's obvious, yeah. Yeah. In that particular case, yeah, but I just mean in car parks in general. Like, if someone has parked these... I'm not going to swear. These people who park like on or slightly over the line. It's like, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are? You have wing mirrors just like all the rest of us.
If you're in a crowded car park and somebody is slightly over the line and there's just no other spaces, but there is a space next to them, then you have to park next to them and then you're slightly over the line.
Yeah.
When you go into the shop, my fear is that earlier car is going to leave.
Yeah.
Somebody's going to come in and look at this dope he's parked over. I was like, I had to.
Cheek of you.
I didn't have no choice.
Cheek of you.
Yeah. Then I look bad.
Now you look bad.
Yeah. Apparently that's a sign that you have some sort of mental issues.
What?
Worrying about things like that.
Really?
It's like a symptom of something, some sort of condition.
Is it really? We must look that up for next week. Yeah. Really?
Yeah. It's like it's twinned with the notion of, right, we're getting off the plane now and I have all of my stuff ready and I am ready to leave. Why isn't everyone else playing ball? Why isn't everyone else being reasonable and fair to their other fellow passengers by also being ready to leave?
So how is it that you and I are the only ones like that then? How is it that we've ended up working together? Have we just gravitated towards each other? It's whatever mental illness that we are suffering from, as yet undiagnosed.
It has bound us.
That's what it is. That's why Kate thinks we're both ridiculous.
Thanks, Kate. I'm now pro-Ray.
Great. We've both been tarred with the same brush. Anyway, if you're feeling seedy this morning, I was reading the thing about binge. There's a thing about that comes up a lot about binge drinking. And I was reading a thing. It's happened before. You'd be watching TV, you'd be watching a movie, and they'd be talking, particularly in America, if it's set in America, you'd have the sense that, oh, Jesus, the way they are talking about drinking, that is either less than the way I drink, like moderate drinking. The way they are talking around or referring to the way they're drinking, which to me would be moderate or even not even really drinking. And they're talking about it as if it's problem drinking, particularly binge drinking. Makes me go, now it's usually American, because again, UK and Ireland, we're big drinkers. So we probably would have a different perspective and think about drinking a different way to, like, I don't know, a Californian or New York audience. You think to yourself, oh, Jesus, if they only knew, if the Americans only knew really the way we drink, and particularly when it comes to binge drinking, that there is a mental thing that happens where it's like, it's Friday and you're going, well, I've been good all week. I might have only had a glass a night. I've been good all week. But my God, am I going to attack it on Friday and on Saturday night? Attack it. And that is wildly unhealthy. It's the antithesis of the Mediterranean way of having the glass a night. But we've got this thing where, well, not everyone, but there's definitely a cultural thing where you've earned it, or you've been good all week. It's been a tough week. You can let your lugs back and drink as much as you like at the weekends. But that binge drinking has been identified as particularly bad for us in terms of our regular health and our mental health. And when I was reading a detective novel, and they were referring to he had opened a second bottle of beer for the second night in a row. And I was like, and it was the notion that his partner wouldn't be happy with him. She's going to give him crap tomorrow because two nights in a row he'd have to knock this on the head before it became a problem. I just think it always strikes me as odd.
I think it's just a massive cultural difference. I think you're right. Like when you hear of things like spring break, that kind of thing in the US, this is like the one handful of times they might go binge drinking and it's seen as wild and just out of place and just unusual, where it's sort of the norm. It's been normalized here, I suppose.
It's just what we do. But then I suppose, how do you knock it on its head? How do you address it? There needs to be a generational or a cultural, like a change in the culture in the way we talk, or even the way that our kids see us behaving, or the way that they see us drinking. The big one as well was lockdown. Because lockdown was the ultimate Friday and Saturday night. because you didn't have to go in. That's when we all were like, "What? We don't have to drive?" Like there was all the bad things with lockdown. You know, stay within your 5K and be safe and all those negatives. But there was a bunch of excuses to just attack the vino.
I didn't drink wine before lockdown, and I had no particular grow for wine. And if somebody offered me a glass of wine, particularly red, wouldn't go near it. Say, "No, I'm good. I'll work on something else. I'll drink something else." And then I figured, well, I'm at home. I'm spending more time at home. I'm cooking. Jeez, I don't know. I'm going to have spaghetti. I'll tell you what, I'll try some wines. I'll see if I can find a wine I like.
You were always, JP was always like, "Oh, wine. Oh, it's kind of like drinking vinegar." It's like, "Oh, no."
I was really did not like the taste.
He was anti-wine. In the same way that my wife is anti-Ray, JP was anti-wine.
Was being the operative term, because I did do some research, hands-on research, I might add, and tried out a lot of different wines. Got the old wine app Vivino on the phone, so I'm scanning bottles when I'm in the shops and, "Oh, that sounds like it's the kind of thing that I like. I'll try that." And I had a little bowl that I have beside the cooker hob. So I opened the wine and I put the cork in the bowl. And this is not a small bowl. And it did occur to me over the, whatever, 1.5, 2 years of the various lockdowns, that bowl was filled.
We're filling up.
Heaped.
Yikes.
And then emptied a couple of times. So I was definitely drinking this. Some people will laugh at this and say that's not much. Certainly a bottle of wine at least a week, and sometimes two on my own.
Units-wise, that does add up. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Well, two bottles of wine for a male is too much, and I have knocked it on the head since. But still,
do you need to go into Matt? Actually, he needs to visit. He needs to go and visit our colleague Matt Cooper. Off you go now. Go on, off you go.
He'll be back in a jiffy.
The funny one is, and I'm sure listeners, you'll identify with this particularly over the weekend. The old the trip of shame to the recycling bank, where he's in there chatting to Matt. What's going on? Is everything all right? He's back already. You got loads of time. Is everything okay?
Asher,
you were giving him a sort of a weird look there.
What are you talking about? A weird look?
A weird look.
Well, I was. I don't like to walk back into this room right when there's a big red light that says the microphones are on, because then you hear me walking in like a thundering elephant.
I was saying about the recycling, the trip of shame to the recycling bank.
Yeah.
That when, like, there's nothing I like more than making an unnecessary trip to the recycling bank.
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is there aren't enough bottles for it to be remarkable how many bottles I'm putting into the recycling bank on the one trip, on the one visit.
So it's a small amount of bottles.
Yeah, it's like two or three bottles.
And a shameless amount of bottles.
Yeah, so it's like there's still plenty of room. We've got this big bag that we keep all of our bottles in, but the bag is not overflowing to the point of, oh my God, you're going to be mortified. I love an unnecessary trip to the bottle bank with only three or four. But like that, you know, you're putting in all the bottles and you're thinking to yourself, we've got to curb this. We've got to settle down. We've got to knock it on the head. I'm going to do it. Week by week, I'm going to cut back a little bit, just a little bit, and see how we do.
People swear by it. They say they feel amazing when they give up the booze.
Who was I looking at today? Aaron Craskill. Do you follow him?
I don't.
He's not like Squib, another influencer. You'd know him. He does loads of funny videos. He goes into shops. You would know him. Let me describe him before you Google him.
Right.
He goes into shops and he puts his headphones on and he sings along really loudly to the songs and he gives people frights with the while he's filming selfies.
This is the original guy that you started showing me years ago.
He's still going.
This guy's hilarious. Yeah.
He was saying he's sober for months now and it's completely changed his life. He was like, what did he say? I'm a better person, I'm a better dad, and I'm a better husband. And I was like, oh, I don't think I'd like to be any
that
of those.
Appeal to
those,
me at
those
all.
Three things. I mean, in terms of my brand, those three things are like, if I was to suddenly rectify those three issues, what would I be then? What would I be? I was reading the story of Mary Byrne as well during the week. This is Mary Byrne, X Factor Mary Byrne. She's got a new show and she was talking about how particularly during lockdown she was binge drinking. Excuse me. She was feeling very down and very low. An awful lot of people went through this during lockdown, you know, in terms of their mental health and dealing with other people and feeling lonely and low and then drinking more than they should. She was talking about how, let me call my Mary Byrne person. She's touring at the moment around Ireland doing her own woman show. Give me one second. Before we get into the chat with Mary, there's some themes about, you know, drinking and mental health and other themes that might be triggering or upsetting. So if you want to bear it in mind, go and have a look at the Samaritans website. Or if you're feeling low, loads of support services available. Reach out and talk to someone. You can call the Samaritans as well at any time of the day. Their number is 116123. 116123.
It's ringing.
Hello.
Hello, is that Mary Byrne?
It is, yes.
Hello, Mary Byrne. It's Ray Foley calling from Today FM. Mary Byrne.
Oh, my God. Hello, Mary.
Darling. The divine Miss Byrne. How are you, dear?
I'm not too bad, darling. I'm not too bad at all.
Well, it's lovely to hear that you're doing well. And you're performing your new one-woman show. Check me out all summer long and across the nation. You're doing a bunch of dates. You're throwing yourself into this one, Mary.
It's been absolutely fantastic. I mean, I'm still in shock at the standing ovations when I finish doing the show and in the middle of it. People are just loving it and they're loving my honesty and the songs and I suppose the story. Why they want to hear my story, I don't know, but I am so grateful that they do.
I can tell you why they want to hear your story, Mary, because it's inspirational, it's real. And you are, every single time I've met you and spoken to you, I've only ever found myself wanting to talk to you more.
Thank you.
And you're a great company.
Thank you very much.
The show is, just for anyone who hasn't seen it yet or hasn't seen on social what you're doing, it's not just singing, is it? Because can you think, Mary Byrne, you're like, you're thinking show tunes, show performances.
No. It's the whole of my life. I start from last year when I was doing the menopause and we had the bus crash and I go straight into my birth and 70s and on to having my baby and my parents passing and lots of other little things in between. Mm. And then each section has a song that means something to me to that section.
And how long is the show or the performance, Mary?
The first half is roughly an hour and the second is about a half an hour.
Wow, that's long enough. And you're no help. It's just you up there on your own, giving it your all.
Yes, the most scariest thing in the world. And, you know, I have so much admiration for the likes of comedians who stand on that stage and try to just hold an audience. It's incredible. And I have a lot of admiration for them.
Is this your first time doing this, specifically this kind of thing, Mary?
I've never done anything on my own on stage other than sing.
Okay.
I've never had to, you know, sit down and tell and talk to people, and I'm actually talking to the people. The people are right in front of me, and I'm talking to them, and they're interacting with me, so I'm answering them back, and it's fun, and it's sad, and it's emotional, and it is a great, and I do talk about a lot of the stuff that happened to me during COVID as regards drinking and stuff like that. So, yeah, it's very honest, heart on sleeve stuff.
Yeah, that's that was the one that that resonated with me the most, and it's one of the stories that I think a lot of people in Ireland, not just in Ireland, all over the world, thinking back specifically about that time, that time in our lives, that yeah. mental time of, hey, you're not allowed to leave your house, and you're not allowed to go to work, you're not allowed to get on a bus, you're going to stay in the house, and you can order in. Or you can and you can't socialize. You'll have Zoom calls with your friends and do quizzes on the internet. By the way, this feels like Mary. This feels like a million years ago.
It was only a couple of years ago.
It was only a couple of years ago, but all of this that we were going through at the time, and when I read your, because you talk about drinking and drink becoming a crutch, but I think. Yeah. So many of us, I know I did. Now, I couldn't say that it was so great that it became a problem. But my God, I tore into the booze, particularly in that first year of COVID. Yep. And a lot of us did.
But it wasn't even the first year for me. It was the second year. The first year, God forgive me for saying this. I know a lot of people suffering all over the world and stuff, but it was beautiful. We remember our weather at the time. Mm. It was absolutely gorgeous. And I went walking and I lost weight and I was fab. And I was thinking to myself, Graham, to get back to work now. And then the second lockdown hit me. And because I suffer with depression, I mean, the last thing I needed was sitting down with a bottle of wine. Mm. And then another bottle of wine, and then another bottle of wine, and I ended up literally suicidal. And it was the most horrendous moment of my life, and I will never forget it, and I will never go back there again.
Wow, that's it's because when you think of everything you've been through in your life, and you know, we look at your. I remember I was talking to you. Was it Operation Transformation at one point?
That's right. Yeah.
And you were on the honestly. You were full of life, so enthusiastic. You were infectious. You're an infectious type of person to be around. And then to think that you were going through that during the second lockdown. Like when you say suicidal, my God.
I mean, I just thought there was, you know, I couldn't see the light at the end of the tunnel. And my poor daughter was suffering, and my family were worried over me. And I was thinking, oh my God, you know, life would be a hell of a lot better off because I can't face this on my own. There's no work coming in. I'm not going to get back to work. My life is in a heap. And I felt sorry for myself, like we all did, I suppose, at one stage. But I just could not see the light until the day I walked completely in a daze down towards Chapel Lizard in Ballyferma, where there's a river.
Jesus,
and it was when I got to the end of the road and the traffic lights turned and I stopped. And for some unknown reason, I seen my local chemist, and I would know them all in there very well. And that's where I headed. And I don't know why I headed there, because I couldn't see people around me. I was literally in a daze. There was nothing going through my mind other than I need to stop this. And that was the only way I could see stopping it.
When you were at your lowest, you mentioned about like your life being in a, your own description, your life being in a heap, or thinking about work. Was it like a work focused thing? Were you thinking like, how am I going to get back to work, or how am I going to earn? Was it an economical sort of worry that you were struggling with?
It was a combination. I felt very lost. Because we couldn't see anybody, and my poor daughter was here and she was going out to work, and I just felt I had nothing to offer anymore. That's how dark it went. Why am I here? What the hell am I doing in this situation? And, you know, do I deserve to be here? And yes, the answer was yes, you do. You deserve to be here. You deserve to be in this dark hole. And I was so angry with myself and with the world and with everything that was going on around me that the only time it went away was when I opened a bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And it went away for the night.
Yeah, that's it. And it's a short-term thing. I can totally identify with that. And that feeling of like, I'm not worried anymore, or I'm not anxious anymore now. And I don't have to worry again until tomorrow.
Exactly.
Mary, forgive me, what's your daughter's name?
Deborah.
I met Deborah at Westlife years ago.
Oh, she was a huge Westlife fan,
I met her. I was sitting next to her at Westlife. And,
and
yeah, we became Westlife pals for the night, me and Deborah. We had a great night.
She's a good kid.
She's a legend, absolute legend. But when you say she was going out to work and she was around, did she or any of your other loved ones, I guess they saw it in you. Did they try and say anything?
They did. My brother would be, he's a counsellor at the moment. He was a chronic alcoholic for years and he's 37 years off it now and counselled people. And he's seen it and he tried to, but I wasn't listening to anybody. The way I can don't describe it is I didn't think I'd hit rock bottom yet until that day. And I don't know what happened when I got to that traffic light and why the chemist threw me there. You know, some people would say it was God, God intervened and took you the other way. Some people would say your mind just wasn't ready to do what you thought you were ready to do. I don't know. All I know is that it was the darkest place of my life, and all I wanted to do was end it. I didn't care. I thought that my family would be better off without me. My daughter would get on with life. She'd be hurt, but she'd get on. She wouldn't have this burden on her for the rest of her life. It was a stupid thought.
That's it. And that's the thing. And then those stupid thoughts people live with then are the repercussions of those stupid thoughts. So those fleeting moments that you think, I'm never going to get out of this. I'm never going to get away with this, away from this. But the concept that this feeling is not going to be this.
It's not going to get any better. Yeah.
Yeah. But also that the notion, I guess, of that darkness, the notion that that darkness could be a memory, Mary, that like, this is something you're talking about as a memory. It's something that happened and it is in the past. It's a former version of you that had to go through that.
And when I talk about it on the show, it's so enlightening for me. And then I go out into the auditorium and meet the people, and not the auditorium, the reception area, and I meet the people. And at least six people out of the group of people that are there will have something that happened to them similar, and they can all relate to me, and it's a lovely form of therapy for all of us, because they're sitting there thinking, here she is on stage and she's telling me that she went through something similar to what I went through, and she's come out to the side and I have too. How you know, and it is inspirational for those people and for me to hear those stories.
And it's literally, there's a woman up there on stage having a laugh, singing songs and telling the sad story as well. That in itself shows that you can come through it. You mentioned therapy. You literally did therapy from once you took the turn towards the chemist. Making right decisions.
I found a lovely lady who I went to through my doctor, and she was just, she I don't know what sort of person she was. All I know is that she gave me all the right tools to work with as my life went on. And I still use them tools. And one of them is a funny tool, and I say it in the show, that I talk to the wall. I take Shirley Valentine thing and I talk to the wall every morning when I'm feeling low, and I tell the wall, I am worthy and I am deserving of this, and this is what I'm going to do today. So you, Mr. Negativity or demons, whatever way you want to call it, can go and excuse me on the radio saying piss off. And it works. It works if you keep doing it.
Do you do it every day?
Every day, every morning. Well, only when I really feel bad.
Okay. Right.
Because, you know, like when you suffer with depression, it just doesn't stop. It doesn't turn off because you're taking antidepressants or you're seeing a counsellor.
Yeah.
You still have all those dark thoughts in your head. You've got to learn to keep them to the back and to make them not, you know, I suppose, to make them not worth anything, because they're not worth anything. You're worth more than they are. That's what you've got. You've got to believe in yourself.
Had you been to counselling before or a form of therapy in the past?
No, I just went to my doctor. I started on antidepressants and they worked for a while and they still work. I can never come off them, but that's neither here nor there. I mean, I'm 64 now, so I don't really care. The way I look at it is this, is if something is keeping me straight-minded, I'm going to keep taking it. And if I need to do more, which you see, I didn't for a long time until this happened to me in COVID, I decided, well, look, the tablets are working, but you need something else.
That's what they all say. Yeah, and any doctor generally that I've found that if a doctor is prescribing you antidepressants, they say, I'll give you the chemicals, but something else is going on that you need to address, and the only way to address it is by talking to someone.
Your emotions. I mean, I have never felt worthy of anything. I've always had very low self esteem. I don't like myself sometimes, and I don't know why. I don't know what the reason is. So I need to talk about those things. And when I talk about them and the person comes back with something, it just, you know, I know I can see the reason in it And I said, I'm being silly. But you can't tell your mind that you're just being silly. Your mind is telling you something is wrong, that you're wrong. You're not worth anything.
And you need to address it. Yeah. Did you have any preconceptions about therapy or about counselling before you went to it? Do you know the way we'd see TV shows or in films, the way it works?
I tell you why. Because unless the person has gone through it, they can't understand you. Mm. That's what I believed. And I still think a certain amount, like alcoholism, and I'm talking about alcoholics, they need to go to someone who knows what they've gone through. And that's why I think AA is a huge, and there's loads of other, you know, places they can go as well. But my brother's AA, and he would be very spiritual now. And they understood what he was going through. So I always thought going to a counsellor, the counsellor doesn't understand what I'm going through. How are they going to help me?
Yeah.
Well, I was wrong, because what helps you is being honest, telling exactly how you're feeling, and then listening to the advice you're being given. And that's what helps. It's not the fact that she needs or he needs to know, you know, that the problem you have. And the gas thing about it is a lot of counsellors and psychiatrists go and see a counsellor because they're taking on all aircraft.
They need
to clear their own heads. So they do understand that those moments and those feelings you have, and they know that your brain is a very complex computer. You know, it works completely different to anything else you could ever work with. And you need to work on that brain and keep the good bits going and try to always keep the dark bits in a small corner. And when you feel them creeping up, deal with them. Don't just let them constantly come over you and get bigger and bigger and bigger. At the moment, the way I look at life is the molehill is still a molehill. It hasn't turned into a mountain yet.
Yeah. That's it. And it'll always be there. You'll never annihilate the molehill. I'm interested in what you say about tools, having tools, because there's kind of this, as I see it, there's kind of the two strands to the therapy idea. One is dig into what's causing it, like something in childhood or something in your past or something that in your psyche that is causing you to feel or to think this way that is causing these feelings.
Well, I found out that, you know, it was a lot to do with my childhood, and not really? That anyone ever hurt me or anyone ever didn't love me, but there was a lot of parties in our house, there was a lot of alcohol in our house, and my parents, my dad in particular didn't really drink, but my mum loved her drink, and there was a lot of, you know, as I said, you're in that environment, and it has to affect you. It has to affect you. I don't care what anybody says. And I was affected by it, and I didn't even realise it until I got older. Now I still have a drink, but I am constantly, constantly watching what I drink. You know, I watch. If I go over a limit, I'll say, that's it, I've enough. I never used to. I used to just get pissed and go off and do me thing and wake up the next morning with all the guilt. What did I do last night? Ring me friend. Did I say anything wrong? I don't do that anymore. I try not to go over a limit. I like a little social drink now, and that's it. I don't drink in the house at all.
Yeah, I suppose so many of us do that as well. It is binging. It's that sort of go. Listen, I'll be good Monday to Friday or Sunday to Friday, but then once Friday comes along,
That was me.
Yeah,
that was me. Yeah, definitely that was me. I'm going out tonight with friends. I'll have a couple of glasses of whatever I'm going to have, a Coors Light, a beer, maybe a glass of wine. I don't know. But in my mind, constantly, there's the fact that I know I cannot go over a certain limit because it's not going to work for me. Mm. So I'll enjoy what I have and the company I'm in. And I'm not saying I never get drunk. I do. I was in Tenerife there and I got absolutely smashed. And we had a laugh. But I didn't do anything wrong. I came home. The next morning I woke up and said, did I do anything wrong? No, you were grand. You were great. You were just pissed. And that was it. And I liked that. That was all right. But I don't want to do that all the time because life's too precious to forget what you did for your memory to get, you know, muddled up with alcohol.
How long did you do the therapy for? Was it like a weekly thing?
I'm still kind of doing a little bit. Right. I did it for a full year after the lockdown. I did a full year constant every week going down. And she was very good. She was on the phone to me as well when I was feeling down anything like that. So, you know.
And then you check in with her as you need it now or every month or every couple of months. Yeah.
I just have to give her a buzz or a text and say, you're free, and she'll come on the phone to me and we'll talk. And she listens to everything I say and she'll go, yeah, well, don't go back there now because you're going backwards there. Bring it forward. And that's what it's all about, going forward, looking at what you have and the precious things that you have and the confidence that I've gotten, even though I still sometimes don't feel worthy of it. But I have grown in confidence, and I have so many people who come and pay money to see my show and stand up and give me, you know, I have to stop being an ungrateful, stupid bitch to myself. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. You yourself, that earlier version of yourself, even that version of yourself that was thinking the absolute worst thoughts, she gave birth to this now. She created this. She's the one that has helped create this version that is getting the rounds of applause. Writing the show then, when you've got an incredible story, the whole story, the X Factor. And by the way, I'm always conscious that whenever I am interviewing you, it's like, so what was Niall Horan like? And my cat, Jesus, let's talk about something else for the love of God. And Louis Walsh,
I don't even mind that though.
Really?
Because, I mean, a lot of people turn around and say, oh, we've heard such and such saying it was a horrible time. I didn't have a horrible time. I stood up for myself if I had to, which I didn't have to.
Yeah.
And I was looked after really well on it. And look at the platform I got from it.
Yeah.
For God's sake, you know, my hand's in that many pies, I don't know which one I want to eat. And that's the way to put it.
But yeah, but like I say, you've got such a story. When you're putting that story together for the stage, did you do it yourself? Did you have help in terms of like constructing it around songs and around a sort of a narrative arc for the show?
I had a guy called Rob Murphy. I don't know whether you've ever heard of Rob. Rob is, you know, Alan Hughes and Carol, their panto.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Well, Rob would be their dame, and he has done a course in you know, theatre and stuff like that. And we got together, and he said, look, I'm not going to take it from the book that Eddie Rowley wrote, but I'd like to interview you. So we sat and he interviewed me, and he put the play together. He put the whole lot of the story together. I picked the songs, and and that was it. We just collaborated on that, and he's done a great job on it. And even Donald Shields, who is producing it, the stage set that we have, it's just like in your sitting room. You're sitting in my sitting room.
Yeah, and you're telling your story, yeah. And you know better than anybody else, I suppose. And that's your literally your stage. That's where you perform at your best. There's a bunch of dates, Mary. I've got them here. Let me mention them. The 14th of June in Tralee, the 21st of June in Carlow, Wexford Opera House on the 22nd of June. You're in Kilkenny on the 28th of June, 29th of June in Limerick. And I'm sure more dates we can find on facebook.com/ Mary Byrne Music, or do a search for Mary's name, Mary Byrne, on ticketmaster.ie. Mary, it's been lovely talking to you again. I'm delighted to hear you're well. Tell Deborah I said hello, and play a Westlife banger for me. A bop baby. And keep well. That's the most important
you
thing.
You too,
keep well.
Darling. And listen, thanks for having me on to talk about this, because we need to just own up that we're not all perfect.
Absolutely,
but we can live life.
Yeah, most of us are imperfect, and that's the joy of it, isn't it? Mary Byrne, thank you so much for joining me. And have a lovely day. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye. Bye.
Lovely chat with Mary Byrne, and lovely to see that she's doing well. And great to see that she's getting the reception and the audiences around Ireland. You can go and check out her show. And remember, the Samaritans helpline number. You can call Samaritans at any time of the day on 116 123. Email us, jp@todayfm.com. I'm on the gram at Ray Foley Insta. We're back on the radio 2 p.m. on Monday afternoon. Have a lovely rest of your weekend.
Uh-oh. Ray Foley.
Oh, here we go. Here come the details.
Weekday afternoons from 2 on Today FM.
Ray.
Yeah.
I love the show.
Hey!